As many of the people you will hear in this podcast point out, Aotearoa New Zealand is inhabited by multiple cultures, including Māori, the tangata whenua, or indigenous people of Aotearoa, Pākehā, the descendants of the European colonising groups, and later migrants from around the world, including Asia and the Pacific Islands. However, much of our political, social, legal, and educational infrastructure is dominated by Western paradigms. This includes the structural supports, understandings, and expectations of performance within the professional domain of the contemporary arts. I asked everyone, if the structures around performance are dominantly Western, how can we make space for, or work with, or from other cultural paradigms in this context? In this podcast, Louise Te'u, Murray Edmund, Rose Martin, Val Smith, True Paraha, Sean Curran, Mark Jackson, Alice Longley, Moana Napier, Alexa Wilson, Alison East, Sally J. Morgan, Kalisalaite Uhila, Sally Barnett, Carol Brown, Craig Cooper, and Stephen Bain grapple with the history of cultural influence and appropriation, agency, and how one might navigate working across cultures and creating space for difference and shared knowledge. In doing this, they reflect the four strategies that Linda Tuhuwai-Smith outlines in her book Decolonizing Methodologies. These include a strategy of avoidance, deliberately not working with material or concepts, a strategy of personal development, seeking knowledge or understanding, a strategy of consultation, seeking support, consent, and mentorship from members of a culture, and finally, a strategy of making space, a power-sharing model across all levels of a given field of production.
That's an ongoing question because, more and more projects, intercultural will come from an understanding of multiple backgrounds, and I think you have to think about it very carefully at the beginning how you approach it.
I just think that Western thing is, I mean, this I would kind of say now it's a sort of global thing because there's been so much heavy input into so-called Western things for so long from Eastern sides that there's been so much give and take on that global scale from big cultures, whether it's Indian or Chinese or Japanese, very big influences on Western art, hugely, I mean, the Japanese craze is 140 years ago, really, 130 years ago, isn't it, in Europe? So everyone was wearing Japanese, decorating Japanese, trading Japanese, importing Japanese, making huge amounts of money out of it.
I actually just saw a performance last night that made me think of this. It was four short works, and the first work, it's about 17 minutes long, and it was, let's just say, Western contemporary dance, performed to a soundscape of, I'm not sure, I think it was just Arabic and Hebrew, but they had the call to prayer in there as well as a soundscape. And as someone that is very familiar with a Middle Eastern context and way of working, I found that really, like, you're put dancing to a call to prayer in Arabic. Usually whenever the call to prayer comes on, dancing, even if you're in a studio, you stop just for that time. And I found it really interesting that they've chosen to dance to this, and I wondered if they had done this purposefully or were doing it in some way to kind of provoke a discussion, ideas, that sort of thing. So I looked in the program notes and I couldn't see any reference to anything in there that indicated that this was a kind of, they were conscious of this kind of, what I saw as a big kind of clash of like, ooh, very sensitive here. And so afterwards I talked to the choreographer and asked about it, and the response from the choreographer was that they just really liked that sound, that there was no awareness of the context in which that was coming from. To me it seemed like they'd just taken it taken it and plonked it in there.
So taken it without a kind of without sense of understanding.
Without a sense and understanding of where that's coming from. And the cultural considerations around using that in, it's more specifically in relationship to a moving body in space, because that is something that within an Islamic context is has huge complications and implications and considerations. If it had been something more local, used in the same way, it possibly wouldn't have been, maybe they wouldn't have used something that was local because they would have had more awareness or considerations about, oh, this could, I might need to actually really consider how I'm using this. Or perhaps someone would have said along the way in the creative process, oh, maybe you need to kind of address this, this and this before you just go and use this. So that could be another thing, but I think there is a lot of it going on.
I think the tricky thing is it's kind of often the people then stop using material.
That's the thing, because
rather than
go kind of other extreme and go, I'm not even going to go near there because it's just too much.
So I'm going to monoculture myself to simplify things,
yeah,
as opposed to intelligently address something.
Yeah,
which is also kind of possibly unethical.
Yeah, and I think a lot often it's because people, they're not sure how to approach it. They're not sure how to address these concerns, so they steer clear of it.
How I would describe it at the moment is still very much the tokenistic, yes, oh, we want to hear what you have to say, but it's from our perspective that we want to hear it, and it's still how to fit that into the whole Western cultural context.
Mm.
It's something that comes more and more to my attention in terms of that lineage in the dance community from the modernist and then through the postmodernist thing to today, where it's really a Western model, and you know, being in the university institute, you know, it's really plainly obvious who is being emphasised in terms of our studies, and that Indigenous knowledge and culture is not really focused on in that course, and you know, not in any dance course. And you know, I'm not so familiar with other performance courses, but in terms of dance, there is so much a practice of colonizing, I would say, through this is how it should be. If you're making a dance, it should reference this, and that just goes straight back to this lineage. So it's this kind of crazy thing.
I'm not sure if they're doing it better elsewhere, but from what I've observed and experienced, it's kind of atrocious. It's almost like you can only really be sensitive to something that you are engaging with or have engaged with. Like, otherwise it's sort of, it becomes paternalistic, that sensitivity to the other, in a way that is sort of marginalising them, whatever that otherness is.
I was thinking about this too with this Bebek thing, and I suppose it, with the that the whole idea of cultural, you know, other, positioning people away from yourself in that way is sort of so, is such a default Western position to start from, so that somehow, okay, so now I'm going to take on other knowledge forms because I've identified them and I've set them over there. And so, and it just seems really problematic as a kind of a, as a conceit. And so how do I sidestep that? And somehow, I suppose, the idea of a culture of one is my only kind of response at the moment, where the kind of the uncertainty of all that's kind of in and around in terms is provoking kind of this a potential sort of shift in the knowledge base in a way that is as equally sort of volatile as it would be as some group that I'd identified. So somehow Does that make sense? This is completely nuts, actually, this idea.
I mean, I can give a very simple answer and say, well, of course, all of our ethical responsibility, I mean, in terms of if we think about indigeneity and we think about what I've just said about marginality and making a work that foregrounds the causes and concerns of an oppressed minority without actually allowing that minority to speak, then of course you're simply replicating a colonial framework. But what does it mean then to give that space? If we're talking about an indigenous people, to give that space, how can you give them that space when that space is always already theirs? And you've taken it in the first place. So is it kind of giving back that space? And on whose conditions is that giving back? And so the question of Indigenous New Zealand and giving the space for that voice is a complex one, very complex one. And it reminds me of actually some... a discussion, in fact, that Jacques Derrida had around the always open contestation between what he called culture and the social, between cultural identity and social justice. And we like to think that the questions of cultural identity, the questions of social justice will always coincide. But in fact, what he sees as those are irreconcilable or always open and contestatory ground in which we're always kind of trying to negotiate things. The question of identity very often circulates around a closure around the question of whose social is it and how the question of justice operates. And of course, for Derrida, justice is one of those non-deconstructible and impossible notions. We never can have justice. We can only have a kind of prolonged and forever kind of differing and deferring negotiation of what constitutes justice. But always the question of identity and whose identity and the contestatory frameworks of identity will be in tag and relay, but never in coincidence with justice. So in that respect, the question of that space that gets open and whose space is it and whose space was it in the first place and is giving over that space a continuation of a colonial mentality, or how do you give back without actually you being the agent?
I went to an ethnography conference where there was some really interesting discussion of people working in Māori studies or working with anarchist groups, where they were intending to advocate for certain minority groups, but what they ended up doing was inadvertently stamping the majoritarian position. And what was so interesting was that their intention was utterly advocacy. It was utterly to work against the majoritarian position. But those positions are so powerful in our language, in our maybe our subconscious might be, I don't know if that word is the right word, but they just hide away in language and in behaviours and in the kind of the culture that people so often don't realise that they're patronising or belittling.
Well, I guess you're talking about performance in a Western institutional context.
Yes.
And which is only one kind of form of performance. And in terms of performance art, it's only one very small part of what is a global, it constitutes to all the global traditions of performance, you know. But really, there you're touching on an issue of perspectives and whose ideas for, you know, which way you're looking at it.
I've lately been thinking about how much, you know, within this strange little post-colonial country that we live in, so isolated from the rest of the world but yet so connected, how Pacific we really are in some ways, and the influences of Pacific cultures on New Zealand culture and also Asian cultures as well, which is a generalised word, but there are so many aspects that are influenced in a really positive way by, like, the community and the family and the inclusiveness and the generosity that Pacific cultures have, and Māori, and potential kind of expressiveness too through performance. And so, you know, it is a really, I feel like there's really intense kind of unsaid like kind of discourses happening in that domain, in the arts or in general, but like, yeah, it's kind of a really, it's like the elephant in the room or something culturally.
Given the specific New Zealand context, New Zealand, I think Aotearoa is still a colony in some ways. I find post-colonial only a part of the story. I think that many things are still colonial. I don't think it's always sort of entirely bad, but certainly the colonial situation, you know, for the people who came as colonisers like me, is different from the people who were here and the people who are subsequent immigrants. So it's become quite a complex set of relationships. So, you know, the Treaty of Waitangi, in relation to a bicultural ethic for the country, in other words, you know, how we act towards each other, is really important. And there's obvious reasons for that.
We have a special situation here as a officially bicultural society. And so we better get used to two lots of rules. And so when we're working in with particular cultural material, Māori material, for instance, we go there to ask permission. We go there to discuss the pros and cons of the working process, and we try to adopt a kaupapa Māori approach to what we're doing.
I think, you know, that's a really New Zealand question, and something that anybody with an accent like mine should be very careful about the answer. And you know, it comes up in different ways.
Yeah,
I think.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I come from the background of working in the UK, where really the issue is multiculturalism, because the Indigenous people are the people who are in power. They are the white English people, and so the people who come with who have different cultures are people who are, you know, incomers. And our wide range of communities. And that was, again, that was a debate around the notion of cultural democracy. And my position on that was cultural democracy is about self-determination. So it isn't, I always felt it wasn't for me as a white Welsh woman artist to go into, say, an Afro-Caribbean community and give them any advice on how they should structure their cultural life. And it was a big argument that we used to have. There were these guys at Freeform and some of the other big community arts groups that were haranguing us all because we weren't working in the Afro-Caribbean or Indian communities. And it was interesting because it was mostly the younger women who were saying, but it's about self-determination. I mean, this is we're on the left, but what you're proposing is a kind of cultural imperialism, is that you have the answers to their cultural issues. So it wasn't in any way a kind of, I'm not interested in this because, you know, it's boring. It's like, this is a real minefield. It's like, who am I to tell Indian women how they should make art or how they should work in their community? Or to facilitate without a deep cultural understanding of their of what's important to them and how they would want their voice to be.
And I have the same feelings around in New Zealand, and which are even more heightened by the notions of mana whenua and tangata whenua and so on. That it's a minefield. And I think to delineate clearly that you're working within your cultural terms is something you shouldn't be. You can't deny, and you can't co-opt other people's cultures. You know, I don't think so. I don't think that I could co-opt in an ill-understood way bits of Māori culture or Pacifica culture from my position. I think, again, it would be an act of arrogance and cultural imperialism to do that. So I think this is unresolved, but I think there are, you know, it is an ethical point. It's an ethical point around whose voice is it and who does it belong to and how do we use it. And, you know, the notion of cultural democracy is also around the notion that you can have cultural pluralism, that you can have these things going on next to one another, and they will start to sort of bleed. There will be moments where there are natural kind of brushing together that will create hybrids. But that's a process, that's a rhizomic kind of process of its own. To any ethical position we take will be based on our European notion of ethics as well.
So what I've picked out, like, you know, because there is different ways of Tongan and also of European ways. There's a Tongan lens, there's a European lens. And then I can also reverse it and have the, like, you know, there's one on the left and one on the right. So when I want to go stand and watch from the European side, I can also see it into a different kind of thing, perspective and performance. But when I, as a Tongan, I know what's happening. I know I can see it in, I know whatever's happening in performance. Yeah, there's a whole meaning for it.
As Māori, you're brought up being surrounded by and part of performance all your life. It's not the you discovering and, you know, though you gain understanding as you get older, but you grow up in amongst it. You recognise it and it's considered important. Not something you just learn at university or choose to specialise in a professional way. Yeah. Though some people do that as well. But there's this kind of a different, like, more an understanding that performance is part of the way in which you interact with other people.
Well, within that, the Tongan perspective is we like to entertain. I use this word faiwa as entertainment for the audience or for hierarchies. But also, I sort of see it from the Western side that hierarchy is the power. They have the power, and for me to put myself lower than the power, I kind of make sure that I'm keep entertaining, like, you know, entertaining for people that are around. It challenges power also.
Whole field of human interaction that's bigger than the actual event itself. That the event has meaning in a bigger social context as part of a whole other series of events and histories and cosmologies and drawing people together, histories, time, you know, values of time and political, social kind of agendas that underpin all that.
We get used to seeing certain kinds of performance in certain arenas. You know, with theatres, kapahaka is seen in a certain arena. Other forms of performance are seen in a certain arena. And I think what would happen if we all started messing with all those spaces and being an intervention on all those spaces, and then there could be no, we would have to renegotiate those definitions and those boundaries on where performance can happen.
There is a huge responsibility on people in those kind of overseeing roles where they have a lot of power around the way people read and understand what it is that they're coming to see or experience or participate in. And it is something that I would like to see those kinds of people having, taking more time and consideration around how the context that they create really has an effect on the artwork itself and the experience of the audience and stuff. So as an example, the Tempo Dance Festival as a kind of a banner upholds the mythological thing of dance being like a thin white girl on point in a sort of a tutu. Like, it's really like upholding this image. It's like from the modernist tradition. And so for me, that's all sorts of problematic, because already it's excluding, you know, it's excluding a lot of audiences. It's creating a vision which sets up a certain tone, and that's inviting certain audiences and inviting certain types of dance into that umbrella. And so it calls itself the New Zealand, like Tempo, I think it's like called New Zealand's Dance Festival or something, whatever it's called. In any of these kinds of festivals, when you name yourself as New Zealand's festival, it's a huge responsibility, because you're actually talking about an enormous field, and so how you frame that has huge implications on, you know, Indigenous artists and people from different cultures. And so I feel like that kind of level of ethical consideration, yes, that it's not really that thought about or talked about.
Obviously based here at the Edge, the whole way our organisation is set up, the way the venues are, the way, you know, for an audience member to access our venues is very, very kind of, yeah, Western tradition based. And so before you've even got to the point of putting the work on the stage or whatever, that there's the whole sort of tradition that sits around that, you know, even just putting the work into a theatre, that's kind of feels like quite a Western sort of way about things.
Well, Bob Jahnke has used this term claiming of sight, or claiming sight, originally in the context of discussing curating contemporary art exhibitions, where they would apply aspects of tikanga to the configuration and design of an installation. Maybe positioning a woman's work near the entrance, likening that to a karanga, or another work maybe as a wero, but thinking through those concepts into the spatial configuration of an exhibition.
I have seen, you know, some amazingly successful, or very powerful work that, for example, a Māori show in Wellington where this one particular company, and both of the works that I've seen of theirs, they, you kind of follow Māori protocol to go to the show. So when you go to the show, there's a sort of a small kind of porphyry, you know, to get you into the auditorium. So it's really that sort of that kind of welcome. It feels very, very different to a kind of a Western, you know, you go in and you buy your ticket, and you know, of course you buy a ticket, but it's just a different process. And I have to say, it feels like for that particular company, you know, both shows I've seen of theirs, they really create a kind of a community space around their work. So the show is just part of the process, as opposed to kind of you go and see the show and leave and that's the end of it. And they normally, to my knowledge as well, they always had a forum afterwards, for example, so that it was more... and I do, to be honest, I don't know if that's related to Māori culture or not, but this was this particular company. But so that people could talk about the work and talk about issues that came up for them during the work and all of that sort of stuff. So from the beginning of the process, when you arrived as an audience member, you really felt... kind of looked after and you felt like you were in a safe space. So for them, that was the way of kind of creating that safety around their work.
I've just been helping Fiona Graham, who's an English dramaturg, finishing her PhD. And in it, she has a chapter on Māori theatre.
Mm.
And she was discussing the role of kaitiaki and kaumātua, how different theatre groups might have a kaumātua to help guide them through the sort of questions and issues that they might have regarding appropriateness or safety of for the people and the knowledge that they're dealing with. So, for a lot of Māori, it's something that they, especially younger Māori, are very aware of, that they might do that for their own protection. In many cases, they're selected because they are knowledgeable.
Mm.
They are repositories of knowledge. And Fiona also discussed this role of kaitiaki, which is like a guardian. In many cases, it can be like an animal, like a bird, or at home in Tokomaru, an owl or a dolphin. They're like little protectors. But that the kaumātua can have a role where they're protecting people. So this idea of kaitiaki tanga, you're protecting knowledge, you're protecting, taking care of. It's a bit like the ancient meaning of curator, that actually the curator was someone who took care of people's souls, you know, and had a Christian origin, in that sense, the curate. So it's something similar, that there's this spiritual well-being aspect that's part of it. But that role could be built, a person with that kind of role could be part of a creative process, could be there during rehearsals, called on to advise. And
well, especially like in Tonga, we have a lot of history and we have a lot of things to talk about. But the thing was, we never spoke about it. We never wrote about it. Because what my uncle, he said to me is, a Tongan man's dictionary is in his head, in the book, in your heart. So everything's written, there's nothing written.
Yeah.
An old person dying is you're missing that knowledge. Yeah. It's like also having that cover book. This is when everyone comes around it. This all like everyone that's around it, they all have the knowledge. So if I go there and join and talk to them, I'll get all that knowledge in a plate, in a bowl.
Mm.
And then that's where I'm trying to just share it around with my generation, just sharing what I've been taught by elders. But trying to hold, like, trying to collect all the knowledges from a lot of people that I meet up and associate with. It's through them passing their knowledge into me, then me trying to put it into a sense of Western and traditional. Without being fixed and without being straightforward, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But through a way that we can, entertain them. I show the favour. For everyone to see.
I'm guided by my friends and collaborators that I work with on that, I would say. I mean, I think there's something about, again, about this interaction, you know, when you sit down to talk with somebody and they share a piece of information with you, a story or some movement. In a sort of Western paradigm, might all be material up for grabs.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But
there's this idea of intellectual property and appropriability,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And that I'm very cautious, I'd say, about incorporating. If it's Indigenous or traditional knowledge, I haven't had that much experience of incorporating that in a way, and I think. What I tend to do is say, okay, like take a story that is not kind of closely held, that's sort of out there. Like, for instance, the piece that we're doing down on the waterfront, is called 1,000 Lovers, and the title comes from the pre-European name for Tamaki Makaurau, Isthmus of 1,000 Lovers, or sometimes Isthmus of the Bride and Her Many Suitors. It's rather beautiful, isn't it? And to use that, I've gone through Malcolm Patterson, and talked to people in Ngāti Whātua people about using the site. So I've gone actually and said, this is what we'd like to do, what do you think? Had a hikoi down there with Malcolm, and he's talked to me about the Waitemata and the sparkling obsidian, and actually he's told me stories about tuna eels, because the piece is based on a story which seems to be a pan-Pacific story of Hine and Tuna. Mm. And I don't know if you know the story, but it's a rather beautiful story of Hine falling in love with Tuna, eel man, and, you know, looking for him in the sea. And when she's married to Maui, discovers he cuts the tuna up into many pieces, which become indigenous fish, the conger eel, his whiskers become the reed beds, and his blood becomes the red stain and the rimu. And it's a story that's also in Tonga, is Sina and the eel man. So it's kind of like a Pan-Pacific story. So I've asked a lot of people, say, what about the story? And nobody's sort of been able to say, well, this belongs to the iwi. So we've worked with that story. And I've asked, and today I was talking with the dancers, and said, well, you know, in every culture in the world almost, there's stories of part human, part sea creature. Can you think of some? And
I talked about, or lovers being cut up.
Exactly, or lovers being cut up. Exactly, stories of that. So I think there's a sort of, I mean, I did quite a bit of work with Marina Warner in the UK on mythographies, and I'm really interested in those deep sort of taproots of identity they're not universal, but there's a universality to many of the stories that we tell, and kind of finding those points of connection. So that's I guess one strategy, sort of tactic, to avoid the specificity of and it's interesting walking with Moana's performing as the eel man. Mm. And we had shared the resources that Becca Wood had sort of found. She'd gone and done a lot of research on eels and stories of eels, and he kept saying to me, well, yeah, but where does this story come from? And of course on the internet it's very easy to pick things up, but you don't necessarily know where it's come from and who does that story belong to, you know. So I'm very conscious of that, and I think it's something to negotiate constantly. In Perth, when Dorit and I made Tongues of Stone, we worked with a Nyunga elder, Irene Stanton, and it was beautiful. She went through, because the piece was about these disappeared wetlands of Perth, and same as this piece is about the kind of lost landscape of the Waitemata, you know, all the bays and the inlets and the Tunamau, the stream. So when you're dealing with that material, you can't avoid kind of finding what are the stories of place that are kind of, as Paul Carter says, places are made by their stories, you know, sense. So what are these stories? And what can we access, and what is appropriate to access, and what's inappropriate? And Irene was great, because, of course, in the Nyunga traditions, there are men's places and women's places, and there were really specific places we shouldn't have gone, you know, which she said, no, you can go here, and this place hasn't been cleansed at this place. So she actually pointed on a map and said, you know, because it's such traumatised ground, you know, in this post-colonial condition in Perth. So, and it's having that, and with the choreographer we worked with there, she said it's about going and sitting with the elders, and she was going to be their legs for them. She said, I'll be their legs. So it's having those relationships with people that are trust, based on trust and gifting. You know, if you're actually going to work with something, you have to give something back as well. In many ways, it's common sense, isn't it? It's like, how do we broker relationships that aren't responsive and attuned? Attunement, a kind of attunement. And I think people, you know, if you're working with people, they very quickly work out whether you're attuned to something.
It's the idea of, you could say, a responsibility-based relationship as opposed to a rights-based relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is, you know, is politically tricky, I think, in a country like New Zealand with the Treaty of Waitangi. It's like there is a sort of whole notion of rights and rights as well.
Mm.
And I think we're working our way through all of that, in a sense. Yeah. And it comes down to, I think, I have been doing this thing about, and I think attunement is really important. It's like if you find a kind of turning to, like a turning towards something, and a give and take, you know, that it's not taking, basically.
Mm.
there's something really appealing to artists about the diversity of the various cultural, artistic, intellectual, physical backgrounds that people have. But most people are only operating within one or two, like mm-hmm. you said. So when it comes to wanting to draw from those other places and those other paradigms, I find that it tends to be this, it tends to be approached in a very paternalistic way. And that is a disguise, I think, for sensitivity. Because a true sensitivity is me, maybe it's like, that's why dance is so good at this, is creating a true visceral connection with other people. Through body, but also through concepts and through these mediums through which language is quite unsuccessful. And I think the approach is the same way that we approach a Western paradigm. We just need to learn how to live it, how to live the many other ways of being here. And then through that living of it, we can engage with it ourselves without having to approach sensitively the other.
A lot of consideration has to be taken on board. You have to, having said that, I think there's, you know, I kind of rest on my artistic laurels, I wouldn't even call them laurels, but, you know, kind of positioning and kind of go, oh, well, you know, I'm an artist, I can pick and mix and do whatever I want. But, and on one hand, that's fine. Cultural sensitivity, I think it really depends on who's making the art.
I'm always suspicious of people who set themselves up as cultural experts,
yeah.
And who, from their position, determine what can and cannot be done on stage. Because I'm not sure what gives somebody a right to determine that, to actually be the naysayer or the yay-sayer for a particular form of expression. So I'm always dubious about that because I think a culture isn't a museum artifact. A culture, particularly in live performance, it's not an artifact that you can look at as an example of what was done at a particular time, put a label on it and put it in a shelf and lock it in a cupboard. Live performance, by definition, is happening right here, right now, at this time that you're seeing it, that you're performing it. So there's always going to be an element of pushing a boundary or reinventing or reinterpreting something. Having said that, though, I think as a performer or as an artist, it's very easy to slip into caricature or almost into parody or ridicule, even. If you're representing a culture that you actually don't know anything about, because what are you doing with it? What's interesting about seeing somebody who doesn't understand something perform it? That goes for any culture and any sort of form of understanding. It's really just about being an artist, I think. And I mean, if your objective is to parody and to ridicule, then yeah, you don't need to know much about something. You can just play the stereotype. But if you're actually trying to create something that's rich and artistically interesting, then you have to know something about that culture.
I live and borrow from things that aren't necessarily, well, they are mine because I've embodied it. I've lived it and breathed it and eaten it, dug it up, dissected it, or stolen it and made it mine. And I just think we can do that. It's all about an approach and a desire, I think. That desire in terms of what generates life and what generates ideas. And we do encounter many different paradigms and cultures and ways of being. And people do become that thing. Or that very thing that has been inside you all along is drawn out by your encounter with that other. And it only took that meeting or that engagement or that seeing that painting or being with that person, having that conversation, to draw out that thing within you that was yours all along. So that's probably kind of And that's not to sort of say, hey, we're all one family, let's like mix all the colours together. And it's more like I'm interested in difference and being very specific about what is different and specific and special, but I'm interested in our common humanity as well, how we engage with our common humanity with difference.
Yeah.
And so I think we can find more effective and more interesting and exciting ways of doing that than we have currently.
I remember doing an adaptation of a Samoan piece once. It was an Albert Wendt short story, and it was for the drama school in Wellington. And at the end of the performance, a Samoan girl came up to me, who I know quite well, who said, "What on earth were you doing? That was so wrong what you did with this and this and this." At the time, I was very kind of taken aback. I was like, oh, God. But then afterwards, I was actually incredibly angry with that person because it was sort of bullshit what she was saying. She was actually trying to use that cultural difference as a position of power and as a sort of a put down, which was utterly personal, but actually didn't have anything to do with that stuff.
Mm.
And when I looked back at our process and how we'd worked as a group with those performers, many of whom had very direct tie-ins to that particular cultural community, I was absolutely sure that we'd been truthful and respectful for those cultural parameters. And what annoyed me is the fact that she was bringing that down to a racial card.
Mm.
And I think that culture is way more complex than just calling it race. And I think that in that situation was just used as a kind of as an expression of power, really. And I think that clearly, visibly, that gets used a lot.
I've had that experience of this filmmaker who found me through the Writers Guild, and I was on there as a Pacific Island consultant or some script consultant. And we met up for coffee, and he was like, "Oh, I want to portray this Samoan character like this." And I remember saying to him, "Well, why is that character doing this?" Because it's a short film.
Mm.
So I'm thinking 10 minutes on film, you instantly, for me, I was like, you instantly have a responsibility to your characters, regardless of whether they're Samoan or whatever, because people are going to define them and judge them that quickly. So for you to have the Samoan character urinating against the wall in the first shot, I was just like, I don't really understand that. And I don't think he understood, not the word, but I don't think he wanted someone who was going to think that hard. I honestly think he was after someone who was just like, yeah, that's great. You know, you're putting this out there, or you could change that for this. Like, they don't have to be urinating at all. They could be urinating on somebody's car or something. And I was
and that one's legal.
Yeah, because it's his own car. But I was just like, and I have thought about, what are my responsibilities as a Samoan, period, not even being an artist. What are my responsibilities in terms of conveying the best of our culture? Because ultimately, you know, you kind of, whether or not you agree with things or with other artists of the same background, you're kind of like, yeah, we have to make ourselves look good to some degree. I remember when I wrote my first play, I was petrified, because you grow up with, and I don't think it's, of course it's not purely a Samoan thing, but your name is everything. Like I've had so many, you know, talks from my parents, especially my dad, who would be like, you know, you either put our name up or you put our name down by what you do. So you kind of grow up, I suppose it depends on the child, you know, how strongly you take that on board. For me, I was just like, oh my God, Tu'u, quite a distinctive name. Like, even if I was a Sione or whatever, you know, it would just be like, you would still be able to trace what villages my parents came from more. And so it all reflects not on the family, not just on me. So I've gotten older, I've just gone, oh, you know, you burn so many bridges anyway, it doesn't matter.
As it is, you know, if you consider that the individual isn't responsible for themselves, then yes, of course, process is actually it's not where you arrive, it's the each individual step that you use to get there. And I think to just say, oh well, the ethics of a situation are based solely on where something arrives at is not it's flimsy. Because it's always possible to get things wrong or to see things that... Or, you know, some people don't take offence or find... We don't have the same view of morals or ethics or... we don't have the same view of the law in a lot of cases, which is fairly black and white. It's written down. So to kind of guide ourselves, we just have to make sure that each step that we take... We're cool with that,
and that's that old thing of, you know, you can ridicule your own family, but when someone else does it, it's really offensive. And it's that same thing I think for cultures. When you're part of a culture, you know what's offensive, and you know what's not offensive, and you know what's sacred, and you know what's, you know, slightly, you know, naughty. You know what's iconoclastic. You know all those things, so you can play around that. But when you get somebody who comes in who doesn't understand those nuances, then you're just going to get a really surface, dumbed-down version of the subtleties. You know, you think of what a breakthrough someone like Billy T. James was in terms of the development of comedy in this country, and that's because, you know, he was one of the first comedians from a Maori cultural background to really embrace and to show the humour of that culture without it being demeaning or being ridiculing. It was the opposite. It was celebratory and hilarious, and we all recognised that. At a certain level, we all recognised that, and that's why he was so popular with both Maori and non-Maori. You know, everyone saw that there was an authenticity to it, and you can't fake authenticity.
I think you can destroy and slay an idea and a belief and transgress hugely without dishonouring the person. It's a theory I have because I was at this tapu noa and mana discussion yesterday, and then when I was in the car with a couple of my friends, we were talking about something that was mentioned about how there's this battle between the audience. This is something that Lemmy spoke about. He saw this battle between the artist and the audience, and that the audience will always impose a kind of interpretation and trying to create definitions on what they're seeing, and that the minute that happens, they're no longer present to the actual event, and that's when things are destroyed for you as an artist. I mean, these are my own words.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, we were talking about transgression, breaching tapu and breaching sacred spaces and possibly sacred conceptual spaces through our actions as artists. And I actually think that is an ethical thing to do. I think it's necessary, but I think it can always be done without a personal affront or a it's kind of like if I was at war and I'm going to kill you, I will kill you with respect. So I think you can kill with respect. I don't quite know how. I've never been to war, so that's probably not such a great analogy. But I've heard that done.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean
it's
killing's
about,
right.
It's about, yeah. So it's just about kind of breaking tapu without denigrating a culture, you could say.
Yeah, and I think you do that because you really know what you're up to.
Yeah.
I think the people who transgress or who are taking radical actions within performance, which might be breaking new ground or transgressing or playing with cultural norms and strong societal beliefs, have actually really thought about it, thought about what they're doing, and are approaching it out of necessity. I don't think you do those things that are going to put you in a vulnerable place or put you in that kind of a spotlight, I suppose, unless you really feel it's necessary. Because when I do this in performance myself, I can't consider not doing it. You know, people say, why did you do that thing, whatever it might have been? Yeah. I just, it was necessary. It's a bit of a evasive answer too, but it's like, I couldn't imagine of not doing that at that time, despite the consequences or how it may have been perceived or that it might be seen to be irreverent. And I do it within my own cultural paradigm all the time, because I feel it's necessary and that it's very right.
You're saying that doing the same thing without respect or just for the sheer sake of it would be unethical.
I think it would be have a different effect.
Yeah.
And I think when people do that, it's very felt. I think a lot of
like it's an insincere act or something.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you can gain a lot from how observing the effect of your work. How it was received, how it's spoken about, how people respond to you in the aftermath really gives you a sense of whether what you did, well, how it was received because certain people can do the exact same thing and not get away with it or be received very differently or be absolutely persecuted for it. And then some people aren't persecuted for doing really irreverent, quite transgressive things. And I'm always wondering, how does that person get away with that?
Or is it even getting away
with it? Yeah, no. But
it's kind of like, that's almost like kind of implying that there was something wrong there.
Exactly.
It's like they're not getting away with it so much as you said, the necessity of it is recognised. Or
I think
what it communicates outweighs any transgression.
I think you've hit it. Yeah, it's a culmination of making decisions that lead to that point, and the point becomes, and the place of intersection where the idea and the action and the people in that encounter in that moment, it almost feels right.
Yeah.
You know, like
yeah.
That is a true act. It's about truth, I think, meeting those moments of truth, and if they're felt, then that can be a successful outcome, because it makes people transform or reconsider ideas and ways of thinking about things, and possibly even ways of behaving, given the next opportunity and that idea may arise, or that moment when I saw and felt that and it made me reconsider many things. Whereas I think sometimes people do things that they think are kind of radical, because it involves sexuality or outrageousness or whatever, and it's not always felt in that way. It's just deemed to be, I don't know, annoying or violent or
disrespectful.
Disrespect is an interesting one, because it presumes that there is a respectful way to behave and be.
The notion of the artistic process is such that you have to have that deep understanding of the culture to be able to represent it and to add to it,
yeah,
and to grow it.
I look at someone like Richard Nunes,
mm,
who is not Māori, and he's the foremost exponent of Taonga Pōro, one of them. And he has this really strong history with those instruments, and those are real Taonga in terms of very traditional Taonga, have found a renaissance and now are only really played and made by a few people. And yet, him playing these instruments is so correct. It's so right. And so what is that about him? Well, if you were to look at his history with those instruments and how he learned and the relationships that he has with the people and with Hidini Melbourne in particular and with other practitioners, and his love and his spiritual or vibrational or connection with those taonga, then it just makes sense to me. So I always wonder about these things of crossing culture and engaging with taonga, because I think it's a personal thing, but it's also who is to know what forces and what intangible energies bring that person to that place and to those things. Who's to know by looking at your face what other bodies and what other realities you inhabit that don't make it perfectly right for you to be with those things. And I think it's a felt thing. I think you can tell when something's not quite where it's kind of off. Like, this person and what's going on here just feels really odd or discordant or incongruous in some way. And then there's those moments where you feel like, wow, I couldn't really see them without it. So I don't really have a problem with it myself. I mean, because I do it all the time. I mean, it depends on what a taonga is. I mean, I'm thinking about things that I engage in that aren't necessarily things I grew up with, or they are taonga to someone other than me in another land. And then I sort of consider, how do I relate to those things and how do I treat them? What drew me to them? Maybe they do belong to me. What is inside of me that I don't even know about? I like to see, in terms of Māori taonga, taonga Māori being utilised by whoever has the true desire to and engages with a real and deep process to be with those things, whatever they may be. I think go for it. And a lot of people disagree. I mean, the same thing can be said about tāmoko. You know, we've got examples of people who have come over, you know, even celebrities, and they've sought out specifically to have moko put on and then sort of been slightly persecuted for it or criticised for it. And I think, well, what drew them to it? What is stronger, their desire and these intangible forces that lead us to these things, or our cultural sensitivities and sensibilities about who owns things? Authorship's such a big thing a lot of the time. What belongs to me? What belongs to this culture? Yeah, I think it might be to do with just a fear of loss, or a fear of the loss of a purity, which I don't... I'm not sure what the purity of something is.
Yeah, it's really interesting how Māori theatre has progressed in the last 30 years, which is all to do with the way that culturally we've handled our understanding of how Māori culture should be kind of defined or integrated. But it's really interesting in theatre because it's sort of been culturally appropriated in a lot of ways, and yet it also has surrounding it a whole lot of, I would say, very restrictive and restrictive generalisations about what Māori culture is. And I would argue that that's been to the detriment of the growth of that particular art, the art form in that particular area.
We've just had Matatini, you know, the National Kapahaka competitions, which draws on the whole breadth of traditional Māori performing arts and combines that into a contemporary format, a stage format with an entrance and exit and a variety of numbers in between, displaying the talents and the people and, you know, their creative capacity, but within a kind of a prescribed sort of format. And there's tikanga that's been developed, if you like, in relation to that tradition. It's become a tradition of its own that has relevance and is derived from customary practices and, you know, in marae context, and there's sort of parallels, but there are other things that kind of pertains specifically to that format. You know, they've been following a particular tradition, and the sort of assumptions that that format has of a very frontal engagement of the audience with a performance group, a set time frame, and all sorts of rules that are there as well because it's a competition.
Yeah.
So tikanga in that context is sort of is part of a broader kind of range of rules and regulations and things, and people in the last one I think got points deducted if they were late, things like that. Well, you know, that had its own rationale that an organising committee decided, you know, but it was heavily contested, you know, I think when I think it disadvantaged certain people. But yeah, but it's part of what keeps people alive, and not I shouldn't say keeps them alive, but keeping the debate and discussion alive about those things, you know, what are we, what are we doing, what. In some cases people are confusing the two,
yeah,
assuming that they're the same.
Organisational ease and historical context.
Yeah. And then and actually think, and not getting with the what's the best thing, with actually having a questioning, ethical kind of mindset.
Mm.
I mean, they're actually more concerned with adhering to rules and having them than they are than the actual questioning that goes behind it.
I find the word traditional problematic because I'm not sure where it sits on a continuum. I think I just get confused about where to place it in a context of time and space, not the concept of it existing or that there'd be a classification for it. I mean, I quite like the idea that there is one. It helps me sort of really locate it more. But in a time and space sense, that which is traditional can be existing right now in this room.
Mm.
And then contemporary is always the moment ahead. What is current is, hasn't quite happened yet.
And what I think, where some people think maybe this is about protecting and maintaining tradition, some might overlook the fact that innovation and new ideas, new approaches is also part of our tradition. So it's needn't be needn't conflict with those creative goals. Yeah, and it can be there to benefit.
There was a big it was really interesting when I went to Singapore last year to a conference with kind of festival, kind of emerging festival directors, and being in Singapore, of course, a massive number of them were from Asian festivals, and they, it was very interesting because one of the sort of hot topics for that group was very much around that sort of contemporary versus traditional work, and even how it's responded to by audiences, but also how it's kind of respected and maintained, and you know, because they're sort of feeling, I guess, was that some of that traditional knowledge was dying out. So while on the one hand you want to present contemporary work that reflects on society today and all the rest of it, on the other hand they didn't, you know, they wanted to nurture their traditional art forms. And I have to say I didn't particularly feel, I guess because the work that I work in here is all contemporary really, and I suppose in a weird kind of way as a sort of European kind of background person, I don't think we reflect so like I wouldn't, obviously we have Shakespearean plays and all of that sort of thing, but in terms of those really traditional kind of skills that people learn and hone, and you know, they've gone back for generations, most artists that I work with don't come from that place. Obviously it's more common in you know, sort of Maori, Pacific, and Asian communities. But having said that, that's not really an area that I work in a lot because that's not sort of work I do, and that's not what I present really. Mm. But it is interesting to, you know, what is the responsibility in terms of, you know, presenting, I guess, stories from, you know, as a program manager here, presenting stories from a diverse range of perspectives, and how we manage that, and particularly I find it interesting in a contemporary context because it is kind of all what, you know, what is a Māori work. I mean, obviously we had Troilus and Cressida, which was all in Te Reo Māori, but it was a Shakespearean piece. And otherwise, do you kind of, at what point do you sort of say this is a Māori piece or a Pacific piece, or and when you bring this sort of contemporary into it, then it's they are stories from New Zealand and Auckland.
Well, I guess whatever we put out there, whatever we propose, we can either open people's minds or close them down. We can reaffirm what we already know, or we can ask questions. And for some people, when going to performance and going to art, they just want to reaffirm what they already know. In some cases, reaffirm the prejudices or the limitations of their own worldview. And for other people, engaging in performance and being involved in the arts is a way to investigate ideas and actually challenge people, maybe present things that they know already, but in new ways to make them reconsider what that is. Yeah, I think there's many approaches.
Yeah. I think we're always in a state of reinvention and of being affected by the shifting encounters that we engage in each day and with each other and with nature and with our world and with our constructs. I think we're more often engaging with our constructs, and so many of them are false. So really what we're doing is just destroying our own paradigms in order to peel back to some other becoming of self. And I think that's great.
The reverberations that it will always have is ongoing, because performance is live in that sense, whether the one performing is living or not. The performance is live in that sense. And that it is never done with. Then I guess that's how I would respond precisely to that question. It's not, one won't be done with that as a question, because you cannot undo the specificities of this particular history of a colonialism. You can only ever, in an ongoing way and very carefully and ethically, negotiate what are the reverberations of it.
Mm.